Welcome back to Dealing Together. First caller?
I bought 3 sweaters to get the 4th free.
Oh, you got fleeced. Next caller?
I traded my old Samsung at AT&T for a new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus and chose my plan.
That's not a bad deal.
It is not.
Our best smartphone deals. Your choice of plan. Learn how to get the new Samsung Galaxy S24 Plus with Galaxy AI on us with eligible trade-in. AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Offers vary by device. Subject to change. S24 plus 256GB offer available for a limited time. Terms and restrictions apply. See att.com/Samsung for details.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
It's rhubarb season right now.
It is. We've got some in the garden here.
Lovely. Is it closhed or uncloshed?
God, don't ask me that.
You know, has it got a cover on it to keep it all nice and pink?
Yes.
That's very fancy.
It loses its pinkness quite quickly.
Yeah, it does. There's some trick to bringing that back, and I can't remember what it is because I'm not a gardener.
No, me neither. I love to look at gardens, but I don't profess any expertise in it at all. I do love rhubarb crumble. Apple crumble, that's good too. Mm. My mum used to make great apple crumble.
Mine too.
This is a little known fact, mum, that I am actually a foodie. I adore food.
Oh, do you? Yeah. You're not very fat at all. You don't look like a foodie. Never trust a thin cook.
Hello, I'm Minnie Driver, and welcome to Mini Questions. I've always loved Proust's questionnaire. It was originally an 18th century parlor game meant to reveal an individual's true nature. But with so many questions, there wasn't really an opportunity to expand on anything. So I took the format of Proust's questionnaire and adapted what I think are 7 of the most important questions you could ever ask someone. They are, when and where were you happiest? What is the quality you like least about yourself? What relationship, real or fictionalized, defines love for you? What question would you most like answered? What person, place, or experience has shaped you the most? What would be your last meal? And can you tell me something in your life that has grown out of a personal disaster? The more people we ask, the more we begin to see what makes us similar and what makes us individual. I've gathered a group of really remarkable people who I am honored and humbled to have had a chance to engage with. My guest today is Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister for the UK. He is to date the longest-serving Labour Prime Minister and broke an 18-year marathon of Conservative government when he came to power in 1997. He studied law at Oxford and told me he never intended to go into politics. I have to say, I was very interested about having the opportunity to speak to a former world leader. And one of the things that really struck me was the starting point idea of commitment to service and social progress can't help but be altered by the actual machinations of politics. Tony Blair is a Christian by faith, and I very much enjoyed discussing, amongst other things, the nexus between spirituality or organized religion and science and reason. Where and when were you happiest?
So when people ask you whether you're happy or not, it can refer to a period or it can refer to a moment. the periods in my life in which I were most happy were probably in my sort of early 30s, as I was really starting in politics and beginning a family, and I had everything to kind of look forward to.
When you were an MP?
Yeah, I'd become an MP. I was kind of climbing the political ladder. Things were fascinating, but they weren't too pressured. You hadn't got to the point where the politics started to really cut into your life. And we were starting a family, so that was great. And, you know, that was a very happy time in my life. Strangely, this last year, because I've been able to spend real time in one place, the longest time I've spent in one place for decades, it's allowed me to focus on the work that I do with my institute, which is a not-for-profit institute that does work in Africa, the Middle East, and other places. But even though I've not been able to travel there in the same way, you know, I've found it actually quite a good way of working. And it's given me some periods of reflection when normally I don't get any. So as a period of my life, it's not been unhappy. But then I think you can define happiest moments of your life. And those for me, which is probably a bad thing, but they're all about fulfillment. I mean, I could say it's the moment my first child was born and my first grandchild, and that's true. But when I think of, you know, things that gave me an immediate rush of happiness, they're usually around fulfillment, you know, getting a scholarship to school or getting into university, winning the nomination for my constituency, which was a big moment.
Yeah, that must have been amazing.
That was completely unexpected, and was the last seat in the country to select a candidate in 83. And if I hadn't been selected, I would never have been leader in 1994, never been prime minister in 1997.
But you held that seat for a long time as well.
Yeah, I guess 25 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a long time. But then there were particular moments, because with prime minister, there were the highs and lows, but the highs are very high. The signing of the Good Friday Agreement on Ireland, the winning of the Olympics. So it's happiness as fulfillment. But if you want happiness as a period of your life in which you're experiencing just day to day, the nearest I would ever get to contentment, it would probably be those two periods, really. Yes. Not when I was prime minister.
Not when you're prime minister, yes.
It's like when people ask you whether you enjoyed being prime minister, I always think,
well, it's like asking you, do you enjoy giving birth? You know, no, not really. Like, I really loved having a baby, but I think that's actually an excellent analogy. Not having been prime minister, but having given birth.
Did you enjoy being on stage?
I used to have a bucket at the side of the stage that I would throw up in. Yeah. When I was in the West End, I was so terrified. There's something great about it, though. But I'm interested about this premium that we put on happiness, because I wonder if it becomes a catch-all, and rather like love, it's actually made up of a lot of other different things. If love is made up of, I don't know, respect, honesty, shared ideas, communion, community. Because I was happy on the stage, but it was also awful.
But I think that's what's interesting about it. But that's why you can define happiness as points of fulfillment. So when you came off the stage having given a great performance, or a performance you were satisfied with, that's a form of happiness. I'm an optimistic person, but I don't think I'm happy in that kind of relaxed sense of happy.
That's so funny, because I think I'm a happy pessimist. I think that I'm actually quite pessimistic, but really, genuinely often surprised about how well things turn out. But I wonder if it's also like, if it's a privilege from where we're born and where we grow up and the privileges that we have in our life. It's interesting about the notion of what you grow out of. Think about that a lot, and certain friends who've had extremely different experiences in their life, who happiness was really hard fought, and they look at it differently. They look at it as this prize in a way that they won despite the hardships that they experienced.
But that does give them a sense of fulfillment.
Yeah.
And I think the best thing in life is to wake up with a sense of purpose and go to bed counting your blessings. And I think you tend to be more happy when there is that purpose. You know, you feel you're not just living, but you're living for something. And when you've got to the stage where you're able, despite all your challenges and your mishaps, to say, but I'm in fact blessed. Think of all the many blessings that have been bestowed upon me. And I think one of the things you try to do as you get older is you try to come to a more spiritually balanced place where you can accept the things in life that are really hard, because you appreciate there are so many people who have it harder, mm-hmm. And you've in fact been generously gifted in many ways.
Just last thing on happiness, because it's really interesting talking to you about that. Do you think that it was something when you were Prime Minister that in a way you couldn't expect it in any way, shape or form? So it becomes sort of collateral damage to the position that you're in, that you can't really seek happiness when you're governing, like, or are you trying to seek a greater happiness for a country so that sort of fulfills that part of your psyche?
Yeah, no, the truth of the matter is the responsibility is so great and you're taking decisions the whole time that are extremely difficult and you're subject to an enormous amount of criticism. Now, by the way, you know, as my wife always used to say to me, look, it's voluntary. Don't complain about it, you know, and that is actually a very sensible attitude. But, you know, the sense of responsibility and the harshness occasionally of the environment, you know, I found it hard to be happy. But as I say, there were those moments because you do have such responsibility where something actually worked, you know, where we were 3-4 days trying to negotiate that Good Friday Agreement in Ireland. And after all those years, and you actually get it, then that's something.
That must have been amazing.
Yeah, there are very few moments, though, which, as it were, where the joy is unalloyed. It's usually accompanied by a heavy downside.
What quality do you like least about yourself?
That I'm never satisfied, that I'm always restless. I used to think for a long time that was a strength, and I think it's really a weakness.
Do you think that you've addressed that with COVID keeping you in one place and that restlessness actually being stopped? Do you think that maybe you've learned to like it?
No.
No?
No, I haven't learned to like it. I'm ambivalent about it because I think that to a certain degree, if you have an element of restlessness, it keeps you striving.
Yeah.
And in the striving, you can achieve more. But I think it makes you a difficult person to live with. I think you miss dimensions of life by being constantly restless and in search. I mean, it's a quality I've come to accept about myself, but whereas I used to think it was a great spur, and in some ways it is, I think you should be a big and strong enough character to be able to achieve without that.
Well, it sounds like you did quite a lot during COVID.
No, I felt that with our institute, we really took it to a new level. So I was very pleased at that. I don't think you need to be perpetually unsatisfied in order to succeed. And I've subsequently in my life met a lot of people who have managed to succeed in their life goals by being very focused and determined and hardworking and apply yourself. And all of that is no one I've ever met. Even if they make it look easy, it never is.
No.
But they've managed to do that at the same time as, you know, just having a more relaxed attitude to life.
I know. It's how do you stoke the fire and keep that forward momentum without, I think, being overrun by that and not being able to focus? Maybe it's just the nuance of being alive.
The thing I often wonder when I meet people is, you know, is it something natural or is it something that events in people's lives have pushed them to? I don't know. I think to be able to be calm in the face of whatever life brings you is, I think that's a great quality.
Do you think you've cultivated that as you've got older?
I've tried to, but as I say, not really very successfully.
Maybe the living is in the trying. You know what I mean? Maybe there's no actual arrival point.
But it's like the other thing I always think is the Greeks always had it right when they talked about hubris and nemesis. That's a very interesting aspect of life, that you should always as well remain rooted in a certain degree of humility about your own position, your own capabilities, because there's no occasion that I've ever come across in any part of my life or the life of people I've known where nemesis has followed hubris. It's a big life lesson.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation. I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or what relationship, real or fictionalized, defines love for you?
So I thought about this, and I thought about it, what is its purest form? I mean, I would say parent and child is a very obvious answer to give. And now I'm a grandparent. It's the same feeling of unconditional love. I mean, what you have for your child is something I think that is not replicable. I mean, there's nothing that comes near it in its unconditionality. But it is, to some degree also, it's bound up with yourself. So in its purest form, I would say the love that I have seen when I've seen people who dedicate their lives to looking after others in really difficult circumstances. And I think, for example, of the nuns I met in Africa looking after HIV/AIDS children, many of whom at that time would die, but they would care for them through, you know, the last years of their life. And that love was unconditional, but also selfless. I mean, they didn't have a family relationship, but they were able to give those children complete and unconditional love. And usually in circumstances where their parents had died, and I remember because Shereen and I visited an orphanage where the nuns looked after these children. And I remember coming away and literally weeping afterwards because I just felt there's nothing that could ever come close to that purity.
Is the distillation of love then for you, is that in its most unsullied form where it's most meaningful? Because you're right, there's a huge difference, and yet they're both worthwhile, the love for your children and the unconditional love of a nurse for a very sick child.
Yeah, and the love for a stranger. So that is to be able to bestow that love on a stranger. I mean, you know, obviously they're not strange when you start to look after them, but the fact is they're not connected with you by family. They're not friends. They're not people who've done anything for you. I mean, that is selfless as well as unconditional. One of the things I worry about sometimes is whether with the passing of religious belief, we will lose something of that. You know, that selfless love that I think is often found in people of faith.
I don't think faith's going anywhere.
I hope not, but I think it's difficult. I think organized religion is under so much pressure, and religious belief is subject to so much cynicism and criticism, as well as an inquiry as to whether it's consistent with science.
I agree. I mean, I think that that's the nexus of whatever the new Venn diagram of new physics or science and religion. I mean, I think it's fascinating and interesting to see what that will look like. But maybe it also forces us to do a bit more self-inquiry and it not be quite so externally structured, but rather to find it within yourself.
Yes, that's true. But the question is whether at its best religious faith should assist you in that. Mm-hmm. I think the question really is whether in this century, because I think organized religion will continue to have its severe problems, whether it's possible to distill and capture the essence of spirituality if organized religion declines, or does it just become just humanism?
My school practiced comparative religion. At Beedale's, each summer, a collective or a person of a different faith would come and live at the school, and they would be available to chat to and to talk to at any time. So we had Franciscan monks and Buddhist monks and Catholic nuns and Hasidic Jews. Like, it was absolutely fascinating. And what I realized in talking to all of them was that yes, their particular form of faith had cultivated the spirituality, but I felt so much that it was already there and they would be doing it anyway. They would be doing it on the side of a hill or in their own garden or at the butcher's.
Well, maybe it's that they came to that spiritual understanding and enlightenment through their organized religion. I think what is interesting is that at a certain point, you know, if you study comparative religion, you realize that there are certain things that all the faiths have in common.
Yes.
And the question is, as people apply the force of reason and science to organized religion, does it just obliterate organized religion, or does organized religion adjust and find its place? Because in the end, what organized religion should be is a gateway to greater spiritual understanding and an understanding of your own self.
So do you believe the latter? Do you believe that it's possible for organized religion to shapeshift and to accommodate the science and reason?
I'm not sure. I think it's possible. I think religious faith can go in two directions. It can either go in the direction of reaching out across the boundaries of faith in the belief that there are these things in common, or it can go what I would call, in political terms, your core vote strategy. In other words, you turn in on yourself and you become a sort of fundamentalist construct.
Everything has its shadow, even, well, particularly the really beautiful things. Maybe that always has to be there so that you keep choosing it. You keep choosing the light. You keep choosing the good stuff.
Yes. As people learn more about different religious faiths as well, I think certainly this has happened to me. I'm a practicing Christian, but I go to Israel a lot. And so I see a lot of people of the Jewish faith, obviously because of the work I do of the Muslim faith too, Hinduism, Buddhism. I think the question all main religious faiths struggle with today is how do they separate the essence of that faith and how it teaches you to live a life from the doctrine and the practice, which has grown up in particular cultures in particular ways that often serves as a barrier to understanding.
Yeah, certainly identity politics in America, for there to be common ground in a way. It's really tricky, but
I'm not a fan of identity politics. I think
no, we just watched it play out in real time of who's a fan of identity politics. But I do hope that religion can, I like the word embrace, because that always has felt the fundament of faith, that it can embrace an evolution, which might be counterintuitive, but
yeah, well, it's going to have to, I think, in the end, otherwise it won't connect.
It won't survive.
Yeah.
So is there something in your life that has grown out of a personal disaster?
I'm not sure in politics I can really, but in my personal life, I think when I was young and my father became very seriously ill when I was 10 years old. It more or less ended his career. And, you know, he had to be looked after by my mother for several years. And then my mother died when I was quite young. I think those are the things that probably set my life on a different course.
Well, I think the rest of your life emerging after an incredibly painful start is something growing out of that hardship. I mean, no doubt conflict creates action.
Yeah, and I think what it did for me was create a sense at a very early age that you couldn't take anything for granted. I mean, it may be that that is the only kind of upside of that restless spirit fault that I talked about earlier. In politics and adversity, you know, I started supremely popular as a prime minister, and then, you know, obviously post 9/11 and the Iraq war and all of that, it was very difficult for me to come to terms with the fact that you know, I can say I thought I was doing the right thing, but, you know, the unpopularity that comes then with a decision like that, you then come to terms with the fact that you're given that enormous responsibility and there is a sort of crushing element about it. And you've got to be prepared then to live with that. If you're looking at it from the point of view of someone who gets to the very top in a profession, there are things that leave you with a mark afterwards that you will live with for the rest of your life. And that's coming to terms with that is also something that is beneficial.
Well, I think it's exactly what you spoke about, humility of maybe seeing the panoply of our entire life, and that those moments that have the spotlight thrown onto them, that we live around them. I mean, obviously, I can't speak to what that is of making decisions that affect people or affected people on such a huge level. But I think that's why it's so interesting to talk to so many different types of people, because we're human and the choices that we make are the choices that we make. And I think it's interesting what you said about belief as well and going into politics. You have to have belief. You have to choose a path.
One thing that I did learn about politics, but I think it's an interesting lesson in life, is that if you calculate too much, you miscalculate. In other words, when you're looking at the way your life is going to go in the future, it's often better to follow your instinct, just keep relatively true to yourself, because if you're always trying to calculate your next move in that very narrow way, you often end up failing because the world changes in a way you didn't anticipate.
It's so true. I worked very briefly with Robert Altman on a commercial for something once, and I remember at lunch, I had one of the best conversations I've ever had with anyone, where he said that, you know, your life and your decision and your belief and your commitment to what it is you're doing is this straight line, and that public opinion and zeitgeist and all these other things kind of bisect and zigzag that straight line your entire life. And, you know, he must have been 80 when we made that commercial. And he said, never once in following the zigzag did anything really productive happen, except my realizing that I should really just don't follow the zeitgeist, just commit to your line.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure that I think that's, for me, I would never have become leader of the Labour Party if I'd simply calculated, because I definitely did not follow the traditional path to leadership. I was way out on a limb at points. And that looked like it was a fatal flaw, but it turned out to be. Then the leadership question came up when John Smith, who was the previous leader of the Labour Party, tragically died, and the leadership of the Labour Party came up. After John's death, it was then suddenly I was the right person, the right place, right time.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite in powerful conversations. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. I want you all to join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. In every episode, we gather a seasoned elder.
But even with a child, there's no such thing as the wrong thing if you love them.
Myself, as the middle generation, I don't feel like I have to get married at this big age in life, but it is a desire I have and something that I've navigated in dating. And a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations.
I'm very jealous of your generation that didn't have to deal with Instagram and Tinder.
This is Across Generations, where Black women's voices unite, and together, you know how we do, we create magic. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
Came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, the story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So this is a broad question, but what person, place, or experience most altered your life? And I'm going to say, apart from becoming prime minister, because it's too easy when you have such an extraordinarily rarefied experience.
Probably meeting someone who became my mentor at university, who was actually a reverend, a priest, a guy called Peter Thompson, who was an Australian and who was a remarkable character and teacher. And he changed the direction of my life because, first of all, before I met him, I wasn't interested in politics. Secondly, I didn't really have any ambition to do anything in the world, as it were, as opposed to, you know, become a lawyer or settle down or whatever. And he put my life on a different path by showing me really that unless you lived your life with some sense of obligation to try and do your best and do good in the world, then it wasn't falling short of what you should be.
Do you think it's a confluence of sensing something in somebody else that you speak to, that a mentor sees something in their mentee and speaks to that part of them before they've perhaps even seen it themselves? Or is it them just sharing knowledge that they've paid attention to in the world around them because they've been around longer than we have? Like, do you think that he saw something, or do you think that it's what he was saying through his observances ignited something in you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I actually have asked myself that question quite often. I don't really know the answer. I mean, I think he saw something that he felt should be developed, maybe. And he had this impact on a lot of the people around me. You know, I had a strange time at university because I never felt I really made the most of my time at university in many ways. For someone who ended up as prime minister, I think the only time I ever went to the Oxford Union was once to listen to a speech by Michael Heseltine, bizarrely.
Oh my God, that's like the worst. That's the worst one.
It was quite interesting, actually. I was not interested at all in politics. I was actually trying to get close to a particular girl at the time because I wasn't interested in politics at all at the time.
What did you read at university?
Law. I mean, I had a very good tutor, very good tutors and everything, but I think law wasn't really a subject for me at university. I enjoyed it much more when I practiced it. I would have been better probably with history. But I didn't go to the Oxford Union. I didn't go on stage or anything. But I ended up mixing with influential people on me at university. Peter Thompson was the sort of focal point of all of them. But when I look back now, I think maybe it altered my life in another way as well, which is that I became aware that there was a world beyond my own society, my own country, my own way of life. And that gave me always a broader perspective.
It must be very interesting to see the position of prime minister as one of service that requires a power grab. It requires a choose me, a pick me. And then the notion of service and governing, one would hope, kicks in. But they seem to be diametrically opposed, how one gets to be prime minister and then actually governing. Oh, there's my dog. Sorry about that.
By the way, your question is a great question. So the thing that people find hard to understand about politicians, and you know, I never felt myself like a politician. I didn't feel different from anyone else. It's just that the environment in which you're in, you realize at a certain point in time, there's a bit of it that is noble, and there's a bit of it that's skullduggery and politics. As all these things. Now, my theory of this is that very few people ever get to the top in politics, never mind being prime minister, unless they're driven by belief. You know, and you start in politics with belief. The trouble is, you're always trying to implement those beliefs in this environment in which all these other ignoble elements are present. And if you believe in what you're trying to do, you can't just pretend in some elevated way, in some saintly way, because otherwise you just get devoured, right? So and then you never get to do the things you want to do. This is why usually art portrays politics as just a dark thing. But in fact, most politicians that I've ever come across go into politics wanting to do good. And obviously, oftentimes they will fall short, but it's not that they cease wanting to do good. It's the competitive nature of it and the way that what in normal workplaces would be sort of relatively low-key psychological dramas in politics is played out and under the full glare of
a global stage. Yeah,
and the choices are difficult. You know, I always say to people, the time you should trust a politician most is when they're telling you what you least want to hear. But actually, that's not how most people view politics. They trust what they do want to hear. But that's the easy thing to do in politics. The hard thing is when you're particularly to your own supporters saying, no, I can't do that. It's not right. And when you take decisions, when you decide, you divide.
When you decide, you divide. Yeah. Yeah. I really can't thank you enough. I'm just so, so interesting talking to you.
It's a pleasure, Minnie. All the very best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you. Tony Blair's Institute for Global Change hopes, among other things, to offer, in an advisory capacity, practical solutions to the challenges the world faces. Mini Questions is hosted and written by me, Minnie Driver. Supervising producer, Aaron Kaufman. Producer, Morgan Lavoy. Research assistant, Marissa Brown. Original music, Sorry Baby, by Minnie Driver. Additional music by Aaron Kaufman. Executive produced by me, Minnie Driver. Special thanks to Jim Nicolay, Will Pearson, Addison O'Day, Lisa Castella and Anique Oppenheim at WKPR, Dayla Pescador, Kate Driver and Jason Weinberg, and for constantly solicited tech support, Henry Driver.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Johnny B. Good, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.